Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. Today we ask the question, is mankind trapped? Are we trapped in this cycle of repeat violence and self-destruction? Hopefully today's guest will be able to shine some light on this subject. We have New York Times best-selling author Whitley Strieber. He began his career with gothic horror novels like The Wolfen and The Hunger, which was turned into a feature film by the late great filmmaker Tony Scott. He is perhaps best known for his book Communion, which is an autobiographical account of his experiences with strange visitors who he says came to his cabin in the New York countryside. That book was a number one New York Times bestseller in nonfiction and was also turned into a film starring Christopher Walken. He's also written several other thrillers, including Nature's End and The Coming Global Superstorm. That book was turned into the mega hit The Day After Tomorrow. Now, in this episode, we focus on another book of Whitley's, which is The Key, A True Encounter. At 2:30 in the morning on June 6, 1998, Whitley was awakened by someone knocking on his hotel room door. A man came in and everything he said was life-altering. This is the unsettling and ultimately enlightening narrative of what happened that night. The main concern of this stranger was to save each of us from self-imprisonment. Mankind is trapped, and I want to help spring that trap. In a sweeping exchange between Whitley and the stranger, the unknown man presents a lesson in human potential, esoteric psychology, and man's fate. He illuminates why man has been in a cycle of repeat violence and self-destruction, but can possibly be released from it. When I read this book, it shook me to the core, and I knew that I had to have Whitley on the show to share his experiences with you. So let's dive in. I mean, you are a prolific writer. I mean, as we were speaking about earlier, you've written 40 books or so in your career.
Probably more than that by now. I am a busy boy.
And there's so many different topics we could talk about. But in this conversation, I really wanted to focus on one of your books called The Key, The True Encounter, which I found fascinating. And, you know, when I was reading the book, just really profound stuff that was coming out of that book. So can you tell the audience a little bit about what The Key, True Encounter is? And can you explain what happened in that night in the hotel room?
Sure. I was in room 2545 of the Delta Chelsea Hotel in Toronto. It was the last night of what would turn out to be the last official author tour of my life. I didn't know that at the time. And what happened was, what happened was I was in the hotel room and I'd had a long day of interviews and pretty tired. So I'd ordered room service and I had room service up there and lay back on the bed. In a few minutes, what seemed like a few minutes, a knock came at the door. And I looked at the, I got up and on the little desk across the room, the room service tray was still sitting there. So I thought it was the room service waiter. I looked at my watch and I realized it was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, should I do this? But, you know, I wanted to get rid of the tray. And so I opened the door and this man came in. He was about 5'8", 5'9", you know, not short, but not tall either, sort of average height, rather slight. He had on a dark gray trousers and a turtleneck, as I recall. And he had white hair, a very kind face, an older face. I'd say he was in his 70s, 60s or 70s. Or maybe older if he's one of those ageless sort of people that are around, see every once in a while. He walked into the room immediately and walked over to the window and turned around, standing therefore in front of the closed window. The curtains were closed and the air conditioning thing. And by that time, I had realized I had a total stranger in my room and has nothing to do whatsoever with room service. So I moved to get him out. I thought to myself, this can't be good. This guy is here at in the middle of the night. I definitely need to get him out of here right away. So I started to move toward him, and he said, "You're chained to the ground." And I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "I am here on behalf of the good. Please give me some time." Now, I at this point, I'm thinking, it's a fan. He seems perfectly okay, but it's still the middle of the night. And right. So I'm still very uneasy. And I say, "Who are the good?" Thinking that he's going to say it's some cult group or something. I didn't know quite what he was going to say. He says, "Those whose lives are directed toward ascension." And I'm still not happy with this. I say, "You mean like religious types?" Then he said the first thing that kind of stopped me. He said, "Belief impedes release. The ascension I refer to is a process of finding God within and the universe without." I mean, I'm quoting from the book, but these are quotes. I wouldn't say these are exact quotes, because it was not until 2 years later that I actually wrote this down. It was all sitting in my head the whole time, but I was going back and forth. Did it happen? Did it not happen? Annie, I called Annie the next morning from the hotel and said, because I'm bad about deciding things didn't really happen that did, especially if there's high strangeness involved. Everybody's like that. I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. At least I hope not. Mm-hmm. So I called her in the morning and I said that this actually happened and that she needed to count on her to tell me to write this all down and to not let me convince myself that it didn't happen. And so anyway, back to what's happening here. He, after that, I said, when he says this thing about ascension and finding God within and the universe without, I then say, "What does that mean?" And he says, "Mankind is trapped." And I'm thinking, what in the world is this? And he said that there are a couple of other things. And he said that the Holocaust was the most important event in the past 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. And that sort of stopped me. The Holocaust, we don't like to think about that very much. Mm-hmm. I don't. Nobody does. I know about it. We all know about it. There are some people out there, especially more lately, who are denying it, but it happened, right. All right. And it all happened. Of course it did. And he said then, I said, "The Holocaust was the most important event in the past 2,000 years?" He said, "You were meant to have acquired the ability to leave the planet by now, but you are still trapped here. You may be irretrievably lost."
This is pretty tough conversation to have at any time of night, especially at 2 o'clock in the morning from a stranger in your hotel room.
Oh, right. But I'm being drawn into it by what he's saying. That's obviously what I'm telling you. I mean, I never heard anything like that before in my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Holocaust, it's something that happened. The Germans went crazy. They killed all the Jews. It happened. But I didn't think of it in terms of being a historical event with this terrible resonance in our own lives that he was describing. And then he says, and this has caused me a lot of trouble in certain circles because there's lots of anti-Semites around.
Mm-hmm.
I said, why has the Holocaust prevented us from leaving the planet? I'm getting a little bit confrontational now because not only do I have this guy in my room, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm nervous about this, but he's also really interesting. He's interesting. He's very interesting. So I say that. And he then says, it reduced the intelligence of the human species by killing too many of its most intellectually competent members.
Right.
Well, you know, you could say that about any war, anything. I mean, wars kill good people. World War I stripped us of the whole of the best of European civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And World War II kind of did it even worse. And yet we survived. I mean, the civilization survived. Now, but then he gets more specific. See, he says that because of the Holocaust, it's why you're still using jets 75 years after their invention. Now it's 100 years and we're still using them. So, mm-hmm. Then he says the sentence that stopped me, and this meant that the guy is going to stay. I'm not going to throw him out of this room. He says, the understanding of gravity is denied you because of the absence of a child, the child of a murdered Jewish couple. This child would have unlocked the secret of gravity, but he was not born. Because his parents went, the whole species must stay. And boy, I mean, you can find some really super anti-Whitley Strieber stuff, especially lately, on Holocaust denier websites, because they don't like to think about that. They don't mm-hmm. like they don't want that to be true.
Sure.
But this guy said so many other things that have turned out to be true. I think it is true. Go ahead.
So you were writing about things because you were writing in the book that this stranger was saying things that was kind of beyond the technology at the time. So when you were writing the book, these technologies actually became true, like the gases and a couple of I forgot something in regards to gases and artificial intelligence or something along those lines.
Oh yeah, he was very into artificial intelligence and talked about it a lot. And you know, every single scientific claim that he made is coming true. I got the idea for the Superstorm book from two places. I met a guy who told me about a huge storm that had devastated Hawaii probably 10,000, 20,000 years ago. And that it was so devastating that you could see places in certain cliffs where they had been gouged out by gigantic winds. So it was sort of in the back of my mind. And he proceeds to explain, you know, he might have known it was in the back of my mind. He was something very special.
Mm-hmm.
He proceeds to explain later on in the conversation the mechanism behind climate change. And, you know, I listened to all of this, and when I went home, I didn't write the book down, but I did begin researching this, and I would just go deep into – there was not a lot of research about this superstorm concept on the surface at all. But if you got deep into papers, into scientific papers about the end of the last ice age, you began to see stuff that agreed basically with what he was saying. Weird, very scary things. And then I found something else which has haunted me ever since. There's a glaciologist, I think he might still be with us, named Lonnie Thompson, who studied glaciers in the and Peruvian Andes. And he found at the bottoms of many of these glaciers, which were all about 5,000 years old, plants that had been quick frozen so fast that their cells hadn't been destroyed, like frozen food is quick frozen. Frozen, in other words, in a matter of seconds. And now all these thousands of years later, they're still at the bottom of glaciers. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that the climate changed in not a day or a month or a year or an hour, but in seconds. It's seconds.
It's terrifying.
And there are places in Alaska and in Russia where there are some very strangely preserved animals that that died with food still in their mouths. Something happened, and here's another thing about this. The same time this was happening in our area, a man who is now known as Uzi the Iceman and was in the Tyrol in the Stone Age, and he was traveling through an alpine meadow when he was struck by an arrow and killed. He fell down, and it began to snow. We found his body under that snow 5,000 years later. In other words, he was in an alpine meadow. He was killed. It starts snowing. The snow never melts again. It turns into a glacier. 5,000 years later, it's just beginning to melt. What does it tell us? It tells us that something fundamentally changed on Earth's surface 5,000 years ago, very suddenly. And also, going back 12,000 years, when you see those quick frozen plants, and animals, this happens. And this is the genesis. This is why I began to think in terms of some kind of a phenomenal storm. And he had said that the Gulf Stream would stop flowing, and when it did, there would be a sudden and dramatic change in the climate. Now, right now, the Gulf Stream is stopping flowing. And when it stops flowing, you're going to have overnight this unbelievable change in climate. Now, when I first published Superstorm, which was based on the ideas in The Key, and to an lesser extent on what I had heard from the man I'd talked to in Hawaii, when I published that, I published it along with Art Bell, and we went out on the hustings together with it, and we were just scorned. Matt Lauer, the disgraced Today Show host, right, just sneered at us on the Today Show. He was such a creep, but he was a big star at the time, so it hurt our book bad, and people scoffed at the idea of the superstorm until a few years ago. Another paper comes out, and this is a paper about the superstorm scenario written by something like 15 of the most important climatologists in the world. And this paper lays out the fact that it does actually happen. Now, right now, as we are talking, there is a subtropical storm developing off the coast of South America in the Atlantic, one of the only two we've seen in the past 25 years. And there is every evidence that the Gulf Stream is weakening. It is highly likely that we're going to see more very powerful hurricanes. We've already seen a devastating and very strange storm system that froze Texas half to death. And
most of the country, it was like that. It like literally took like 40% of the country, and it was weird. I mean,
yes,
very, very bizarre.
Yeah. So all of it's happening. It's happening.
So let me, all right. So let me ask you, all right. So while you're talking to the stranger, there's a couple questions I wanted to ask you because there's so many different topics that he covers in the book and that you cover in the book. How can we overcome the crippling fear that controls most of us, in your opinion?
Well, we have to do what we've done in the past and live past it in order to survive. The ancient Romans had experiences like that, mm-hmm. and their empire collapsed. Their whole world collapsed, not just their empire, but everything they understood about the world changed. And we're going to experience a lot of change. It's just going to happen that way. Life changes. Nothing stays the same. But here's the issue in my mind. Question is it going to completely disrupt our world and cause a massive decline in population, maybe a total decline? Or is it going to be something that we can, where we can kind of hang on to things and keep our world together? I don't know the answer to that question, but right now I have my doubts. Because, you know, we just went through 4 years of pretending it didn't exist and it wasn't true. And then prior to that, the Obama administration was not very aggressive about it at all. It wasn't very important to mm-hmm. them. And back all the way to the Reagan years, it was always denied by most administrations, or the ones that didn't deny it more or less ignored it.
Yeah, I remember that Reagan took off the solar panels that Carter put up on the White House.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I have the sense that it's at this point, it's really very sinful to do that. And because of another thing the Master of the Key said, I grew up Catholic. And of course, therefore, I'm terribly interested in sin.
And you feel guilty, and you feel guilty about it because I was also raised Catholic. Yeah,
the Catholic guilt trip is it's not all bad. I'll tell you why.
No, of course.
What was good about the Catholic guilt trip when I was a kid is I have never to this day tasted food as good as the hot dogs that I used to eat on the sly on Friday's fish day, and in our archbishop was very strict. And as far as he was concerned, if you violated and ate meat on Friday, you had committed a mortal sin. So I would sneak off to this hot dog stand on Fridays. And I tell you this right now, biting into one of those hot dogs was just wonderful fun. And then knowing that now the maw of hell has opened up below me. Should I die, I will go down and down.
Yeah, I've always found that an issue. Like, so you can murder someone or eat a hot dog on Friday.
Yeah,
and it's the same. So according to you, sir, according to you, Archbishop, that's the same. Something fundamentally is the problem there.
True in all archdioceses and dioceses. Some of them were not nearly as strict, but our Archbishop Lucy was a great friend of my grandfather, and he used to come over to the house for dinner, and I played many practical jokes on him. But in any case, that's neither here nor there. He was that was the Catholic guilt trip as far as I was concerned.
So why, in your opinion, do you think that humanity is so self-destructive? Because we are constantly destroying ourselves as a whole, as a species, but yet also as individuals. You know, so many times we are just doing things that we know is going to hurt us. Like, you know, you smoke, you drink, you eat the wrong things, you don't do the thing, you do things that you know consciously it's going to hurt you, but yet you continue to do it. Why are we so self-destructive? Why are we programmed that way?
Well, one of the things that interesting things that happened when I was writing the book A New World last year, in 2019 rather, but I've begun being able to write my books with a lot of direct communication with other levels of reality. I mean, call them the dead or aliens or whatever they are. I'm not really sure, but they're there, all right, and they're real, and they do. I am able to work with them, and one of the things that was pointed out to me was that all of this is actually not our fault. But denying it is wrong. And like as I was getting ready to say about the Master of the Key, his definition of sin is denial of the right to thrive. And that to me is the best definition I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. Because if you pretend that global warming isn't happening, you're denying uncounted millions of people the right to thrive in the future.
Well, billions.
Yeah. You are weighing yourself down with a very, very evil thing when you do that, or when you're passive, or when you vote for somebody who believes that. Any of that. It's all denial of the right to thrive. But in A New World, I was very curious about, you know, who is to blame for what's happening? And the visitor's response was, it's your design, the way you were designed. And you came out, I mean, either somebody designed us defectively, if we were tampered with in the past, which I think is a very definite possibility, mm-hmm. or nature, something went wrong in nature. And the reason is this. We have no sexual seasonality. We're always ready at all times. We're not like other animals, which are only ready, you know, a few months of the year. Mm-hmm. We're naked. We have big, prominent genitals and sexual organs, breasts and male genitalia and so forth, very prominent. And we have excellent minds and big memories, very vivid memories. You combine all of that together and you're going to get sex maniac species, which is what we are compared to the others. We're always at it here. And human beings are the most sexy creatures on the planet. And that's why it's overpopulated. It's a design flaw. Do you see that? When they said it was not, it's just the way you were designed. And if it was somebody who did this to us, then they want us to experience the upheaval that's coming. But or they made a mistake. And so, if it's nature, then nature made a mistake.
And I mean, the platypus is a perfect example of a mistake. But I'm joking.
Well, yeah, the platypus is, but we're not platypuses. We're here. Right, you know, exactly. We're concerned. We got all kinds of beautiful children.
Oh, my God.
A guy like me's got grandkids I adore. And, you know, you got all this human beauty in the world, wonderful minds everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful homes, beautiful art, music.
No, the stuff that we can create, that mankind can create is remarkable. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable, the beauty that we can create. One of the things that the Master of the Key, as you call him, said, which I found was such a profound. He said a bunch of things that were profound, but the one thing that I found so profound was that we will drown in our own garbage, in our own materialism. And I found that such an amazing metaphor. It's not even a metaphor. It's the reality. We are literally drowning in our garbage. I mean, the oceans are being polluted at rates that we can't even comprehend. All this materialism and creation of product, there is no other era or time period in human history where there was this kind of commercialism or materialism, where it's just consume, consume, consume. Our entire economy, our entire world is wrapped around consumerism. If we don't consume, the world stops. Like when we shut down the world for the pandemic last year for a month, which was, I don't know, it's like 4 to 6 weeks, where literally the world almost shut down completely other than like food and basic stuff. You saw like everything came to a grinding halt. And what are the powers that be want people to do once things that go by, go by, go by? Because that's the only thing that keeps the engine going. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Keep the engine running. Yeah. But look at it this way. If the engine doesn't run, you got no food. You got we're all broke. The strangest thing about us in many ways is that we can't live without passing these mysterious little pieces of paper to each other, and that's the way we give each other goods. There's something very strange about that. Very strange.
Which is essentially worthless paper. I mean, it's
well, exactly.
I mean, this post-it has the only difference between this post-it and a $100 bill in my pocket is that one has been given the power, and everyone agrees upon that is worth something. Everyone agrees it's worthless.
Currency. We all agree it has value. But, you know, people say, well, we should go back to the gold standard. That would be an even greater catastrophe because there's not enough gold around to support the currencies.
It would be 30, I think it was like 30 or 40,000 an ounce gold, if not starts to get into the $100,000 an ounce.
Oh, it would be much more than that worldwide. Eventually. I mean, if you think of just the United States, but if the whole world ends up going back to gold, as it would have to if the United States did, you'd see gold at $1 million an ounce very quickly.
Right. And, you know, for whoever has an ounce of gold, that'd probably be a good thing. But but you're right. But it's just a strange thing. But the whole
people
commercialism.
Would be melting their teeth.
Oh, my God. They would. Oh, my God. I can't even comprehend that.
No, it would be a disaster.
Oh, my God. It really would be. But the materialism of needing things, needing physical objects, going after things that, I was looking the other day. We had a death in our family. She was 94. You know, she lived a long life. And you just, at the end of it all, no matter what they have, you can't do anything with it. It's essentially almost useless, the material stuff around you, unless it actually provides a service to you, like your home, like your car, like the clothes you're wearing. These are things that you need to survive. But after a certain point, unless it has some sort of issue, unless it has something that really adds a tremendous amount of value to your life, it's just extra stuff that essentially ends up owning you as you move. When you move, you gotta carry all the stuff with you. We have an entire industry of storage to store our stuff that we don't even use. It's madness. It really is madness.
Well, it is in a way, and it started back in Roman times, because prior to that, people did not have a lot of stuff. But then the Romans had the honors course, where you had to a Roman aristocrat had to gain certain honors in his life and her life, and mostly his. It was a male-oriented society. And wealth was important. And these people hoarded absolutely enormous amounts of wealth. You know, we talk about there being too many billionaires in our world, and that's probably true. But in the Roman world, it was like more than 99% of the wealth was owned by under 0.02% of the people. So it was just so unbelievably top heavy. But these people began to amass enormous amounts of wealth. And that continued, that process continued, because leaders began to feel a need to express their power by the size of their palaces and fortresses and so forth. Right. And that became a tradition in the Western world, not so much in the Eastern world, but in the Western world it did. And then it kind of infected India when the British came, and soon the Maharajas were all competing with each other to build the most beautiful possible palace, and the people were left sleeping half naked under bridges. And so it's the nature, it's part of human nature. And now, in this incredibly wealthy society we have in the Western world, everybody to some extent can do a little of it, and we love it. We love it. We're addicted to it.
That's a great term. Addicted. Addicted is a great word.
It's an addiction. Material world is an addiction. I mean, I'm sitting here in a room full of beautiful books and all kinds of paintings that Annie acquired, and I would not trust myself to acquire paintings. We have one painting in the house that I thought I bought. That painting has lost so much value, actually, that you can feed it dollars and they just disappear.
It's a black hole, if you will, of money.
It's like a black hole painting, exactly. She hated it from the very beginning, but she let me keep it up. All of her paintings, I gave all of her paintings to my kids, a couple of years ago. But anyway, I've still got some of it here, and it's beautiful stuff. And I love being around it. And that's just the nature of man. It's human nature.
I mean, just again, if it's stuff that provides value to your life, your everyday life, I get. But there's some stuff like, and it only happens really when you move. When you're like, you know, I've been carrying around this thing for, and I'm now old enough to know that I've been carrying stuff around for 20 years. And in the case of the one day I might need it. That whole mentality of like one day I might need it, and the one day I might need it never comes. And if it does come, you go, if I really needed that, could I have just bought it again instead of lugging it around with me, cost of housing it and all. It's pretty remarkable. But I also wanted to, there was another thing that the Master of the Keys said, which was really, again, profound, was the connection between the three great teachers, Christ, Buddha, and Muhammad, and the different energies that each of them have. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, that's one of the most fascinating parts of it. He viewed those three religions as all of a piece, that they were each a piece of something larger. That and it was in terms of three different forces. That the active force was Islam, because it is very expansive and very missionary, much more so than the other two. The passive force was Buddhism, and the reconciling force that balances the two is Christianity, Jesus's teaching. And it's a very interesting way of looking at a much larger picture of religion than we ever look at, because we look at them from within our religion. We're all believers by nature. Anne used to say, the human species is too young to have beliefs. What we need are good questions. And that's very true. Mm-hmm. And but we have beliefs. And so if you're a Christian, you can't. You're not interested in Buddhism, and if you're a Muslim, it's even wrong in some cases to even study the other religions. And if you're a Buddhist, you don't think that the Christians and the Muslims have much of any value to say. But it's not true. All three of them have great value. He was right about that. And if you look at them in the context of each other, if you look at Christianity through Muslim eyes or Buddhist eyes, you see a whole different set of values there. And it works just as well for the other two. Looking through the eyes of Christianity, you see at Buddhism and Islam, you see a very different set of values there. And now I don't mean that, you know, the believer eyes, which reject, or that's a rejection. No, I reject that because it's not, that's Buddha, not Jesus. But a different eye, an open eye, suddenly you find real wisdom of a whole new kind. It's a very, very powerful statement in the key. I'm glad you brought it up. Most people don't think twice about it, but it's really powerful.
No, it's extremely powerful. And he also said in there was like that, I forgot what the specifics was, that that in Islam you give yourself to God. I forgot what the Christianity is, but within Buddhism, you look inside of you for God.
Yes,
within meditation and that kind of energy. But I forgot what the Christianity was. Another thing that the Christianity kind of another energy, which was three full different energies. And when he said that, when I heard that, I was just like, that is so profound. Because, I mean, I think the era that we're in, and I think it probably started arguably in the 20s and 30s when, you know, people like Yogananda came over and started showing, you know, teaching people about yoga and meditation and those kind of elements. That's when the concept of, in the West at least, of looking inward for God and looking within yourself for the answers began in the West. They had been in the East for probably a few thousand years. With yeah. the yogis and those kind of things. But I think now meditation is a thing that is not – because I mean I'm old enough to remember when meditation was like, you're weird. My mother meditated in the 70s, and my in-laws or her in-laws looked at her like, she is crazy. And I come from a Latino background, so it was a completely foreign thing to them, where now there are apps. And everyone now right. understands the science of meditation. And if you want to just look at it from the physical standpoint, what it does to your physiology, how it, you know, and there's things that there still can't be explained in regards to meditation and the benefits of meditation and looking inward. But I just found, do you remember the other, what Christianity was? And as far
well,
as.
Yeah, before we go there, I'd like yeah, to yeah. talk about just a little bit about Hinduism, which he says yes, some yes. wonderful things about.
Correct.
He says that. And this is really oh, yes. another one of these wonderful sentences. The gods of the Hindus are structures of personality purified into their essential meaning. You know, and I see a sentence like that, and I think to myself, how dare you worry about whether or not this guy is really you? You can't say that. What are you putting yourself up on a pedestal? I didn't say, I never would have ever thought of a thing like that. But it's incredibly brilliant. He says, Hinduism is the path of soul knowledge, for knowledge of the gods is knowledge of the soul. The great systems of self-knowledge were the Egyptian religion and Hinduism. No amount of scientific knowledge of the unconscious will provide as much food for the energetic body as true relationship with the Hindu gods. Isn't that incredible?
Mm-hmm. I mean, no, it's a remarkable. Yeah, I remember listening yeah. to that as well. I was like, "Wow, that is," and to a certain extent, you could look at the gods of ancient Greece and all the different personalities there, and how you kind of, you know, they're all reflections of humanity, which I always found fascinating about Greek mythology. But also the gods of Hinduism and how that has been
how
brought together.
How they're actually elements of the personality. Of the being.
Yes. Yeah. It's massive.
They're part of us. And they're part of every one of us. And suddenly this religion that seems so very foreign to us in the West comes to vivid life if you start to see what they really are. And the other thing that you were asking about, though, he says, seek the kingdom as a Christian. Give yourself to God. As a Muslim,
right.
Find your new companion in the dynamic silence of Buddhist meditation. In other words, you seek God through the teachings of Muhammad. You move toward the kingdom, which is the kingdom of love. It's the kingdom of the five. In the Gospel of Thomas, there are the five trees in paradise, and the number five, Jesus' teaching is actually all about sacred numbers, but we don't see it that way anymore at all. Mm-hmm. We've literalized it and debased it, sadly. But in any case, the number five was in the Egyptian system and in the Pythagorean system considered the number of love, because it adds up the number of man, of the male, which is three, and the number of the female, which is two, and that becomes five. And so it's actually the number of love. And when the Master of the Key says, seek the kingdom as a Christian, he's saying, live out of love. Live in love. That's what he's saying. I did not know that at the time. I knew nothing about the Gospel of Thomas at the time, and I knew nothing whatsoever about the number five and Pythagoras's elucidation of it in the context of his knowledge of Egyptian secrets. So I didn't know any of that. And but you know, this document, the book, The Key, is filled with depth like that I did not know about when I was even putting it down on paper.
One statement that he said that I actually wrote down because it was so wonderful, a wonderful quote, which was that hate is like coal. It has an end, but love is like heat. It does not. And I just was like, oh, so beautiful.
Yeah. And it happens to be true.
It's absolutely true, because hate does dissipate. Hate can't dissipate, but love just goes.
Well, yeah. Well, he viewed evil as being entropic. That is to say, it's like absolute zero. It comes to an end. There's ultimately nothing left there.
It burns itself out. It burns itself out.
It burns itself out. But love burns forever. It goes on and on and on.
Through generations upon generations upon generations, right. It just doesn't stop. But hate.
We live in a universe that's on a journey into ecstasy, and mm-hmm. I don't mean sexual ecstasy only, but that's part of it.
No, of course. Of course. Now, do you? This is a very profound question. What is your definition of the soul? Because the show is called Next Level Soul. So, you know, we're trying to take the soul to that next level with what I'm trying to do in this world. So what is your definition of it?
Well, I would like to talk in terms of a system as I see it. And this doesn't come so much from the key as it does from the pyramid text in the Temple of Unas, in the Pyramid of Unas in Egypt. This text is the oldest religious text in the world, but I think it's something else. I think it is not the first religious text so much as it is the last text of soul science, of a repeatable science of the soul. I think we had such a science long ago because, you know, this text is 3,000 years old, and if you look at it and you look at the ideas in it, they're highly sophisticated. Highly developed ideas. That wasn't the first. That is the end product of a long evolution of thought and observation. And basically what it sees in terms of the human structure is there is a physical body. It is constantly flowing impressions into the spine, which accelerates them in a Egyptians viewed them as a column of light, and these impressions of life are accelerated in this column of light and then fed through an electric body, the second body, into the soul. The soul the active part of this triad is the physical body and the personality moving through time. The passive part of it is the soul, which is outside of time and which has generated many bodies. And I wouldn't be surprised if souls don't generate more than one body at a time sometimes. Mm-hmm. But this is very passive. And you talk about meditation. Real meditation is about engaging the body and the soul in a new way. And that's done through this other body, the second body. When you go out of your body, which happens to me every once in a while, you're not in your, that's not your soul. That's your second body. That's the part that's absorbing everything from this life. The soul is and transmitting it to the soul, and the soul is absorbing this. And in the Egyptian belief, once the body was dead and the soul had absorbed all it could of life, it was then at a point where it would weigh itself against the 42 negative undertakings of the what were known as the laws of Ma'at. Mm-hmm. And if you had lived a good life, you would ascend. And, you know, I had a personal experience of the degree of detail that is actually hidden inside us. Years ago, I believe it was 1987 or 88 in February, I got a call. I was in the cabin in upstate New York, and it was a weekend, and there was a sound outside, like a bugle blowing, a very haunting sound, and I knew what it was immediately. It was the visitors, and they were calling me. So I was about 6:30 in the morning, just barely light, and I jumped out of the bed, threw on my slippers and robe, and ran outside. And I could hear this sound because the little ships they have when they're idling, they make a funny sound, like a clanking noise almost. Mm-hmm. And I could hear that sound in out beyond the little woods that was beside our house, our cabin. And so I thought, oh my God, they're down in the clearing, the place where they'd originally taken me up. And so I went out across our deck and onto a little hill, and I could see through the winter naked woods that they were there. There was something there, and I could see some figures around. And I hesitated because I thought, well, if I go down there and they don't let me come back, what happens to Anne and my boy, our child? What happens to them? And then I heard in my mind this voice say, come on, come on, real rough voice. And I thought, maybe that's not what I want to do here. Maybe I'm not going to go down there. So I turned back to the house. And the minute I put my hand on the doorknob of the door to go back in the house, there were three cries above the woods that remain to this day the strangest sounds I've ever heard. They were so precision that they were unbelievable to hear. The precision in them was uncanny. But at the same time, with this ultra super machine-like precision of tone, of tonality and separation, there was incredible emotional depth. They were the most moving sounds I've ever heard also. Mm-hmm. I went into the house anyway, and I was sitting on the bedside, and there was something was in the house, in the bedroom with me that I could not see. And the next thing I knew, I was suddenly walking around in this strange space with these tall, thin, what looked like wooden columns. And I kind of was gliding along, and I thought, what the heck has happened to me? And then I recognized one of the things in the room. It was my mother's desk from my babyhood, from from her bedroom when I was a little boy. And I had been taken back to the moment I first walked. And it was as if I was inside my baby body with my adult mind. It was completely seamless. And after we die, this is how our lives will look to us in every detail. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't answer your question directly about the soul, but I've answered it enough indirectly about the process that life feeds the soul and why it is so important that we feed it good food.
So that's the experience of what we call living, the experience of coming to this field of existence as human beings,
right?
And experiencing it through different adventures, if you will. You know, being a male in a white male in the United States in 2020 is a lot different than, you know, experiencing life as a Jew during the Holocaust. Like, that's two very different experiences, or, you know, as a slave,
yeah,
or
that's
as
pretty or, different.
Yes, yeah, so it's substantially different. So, but all of those experiences are what feed the soul. And the one thing I found was interesting too about the book, about the Master of the Key, he also said that there, and this is so controversial, I think, to many people, is that evil and good is, that doesn't really matter. There is no true evil. There's no really true good. It's just, it is what it is. And I know that's hard to wrap our heads around that. And I've heard that. And by the way, he's not the first to say that. That is something that, you know, religious masters have said for many, many years,
exactly.
Generations. Exactly. So, but it is still a difficult concept, because when he's like, oh, if there's evil in the world, and like, yeah, but I don't know. It's just a concept that I didn't know if you wanted to kind of dive into a little bit.
Well, he wants us to look at it objectively rather than subjectively.
Mm-hmm.
And subjectively, we look at it as something that's wrong, and that we should have... we should not allow. Objectively, we see it in terms of the inevitabilities of life. And you will find that nobody except a crazy person wants to do evil or believes they are doing evil at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Those SS officers thought they were doing good. They thought they were helping the world. Some of them, even after the war, were surprised at how angry the world was at them. They thought that they had done everybody a good turn.
Well, it's because everybody's the hero of their own story. To be able to sleep at night, you have to be the hero of your own story.
Now, he has more than one vision of evil. I mean, he says, make no mistake, the people can become so heavy that they sink into the earth. Just as the energetic body can enjoy extraordinary pleasure, it can suffer excruciating pain. You have in your body a few million nerves, but in your energetic body, every tiny bit of being can experience the totality of ecstasy or agony. So, you know, you got to be aware of that.
That's a pretty heavy statement.
Yeah.
That's a pretty heavy statement. Do you believe that we're going to destroy ourselves? Is there any hope for us as a species?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
We will go through a significant upheaval on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. It's already gonna happen.
Something's starting already.
It's already well underway. Yeah, absolutely. And it is not it is not going to it's not going to go away. And how many of us will come out on the other side and what condition we will be in, I don't know the answers to those questions. I'm not sure. I don't think it's going to be like it is now. I think there are going to be many fewer human beings on the planet soon, for the simple reason that you said it yourself earlier, the planet is filling up. And we are going to go through a dieback of the species. And you can see in the history of the planet, this happens all the time. It's nothing new, and it's just part of Earth's life. And we're part of Earth's life, too. Now, there is one thing, though, that's a kind of wild card. It's the human mind. And I think that it's quite likely that this will get out of way out of hand before it gets better, but that we will save ourselves, and we will save ourselves through the use of science, technology, and a new vision of mankind that starts with the soul, not with the body.
There was one thing that I remember that as you were speaking, I remember this comment where that when we, there are discoveries, there's things that we take for granted now and we can perceive now that was essentially black magic 100 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
There's just tons and tons of stuff. I mean, the internet and phones and television and radio and flying. I love the flying quote that was in the book where it basically says that the Wright brothers, when they were flying, they actually flew. And then the New York Times said that's fake. That didn't really happen.
Oh, yeah. Well, a very famous scientist in that time, a few months before they flew, published a big paper showing how heavier than air flight was impossible.
Right.
Then they flew.
And we laugh about it now, but at the time it was just insanity to even think about
it. It was considered a miracle, and some people thought of it as demonic.
Of course.
I mean, they always do. You know, anything new is demonic. We love the demonic. It's so entertaining.
Right, exactly. Now, before we go, I wanted to talk to you about your new book, Jesus, The New Vision. Can you talk about a little bit about caused you to write the book?
What caused me to write the book is I am very deeply engaged in work with my wife, she may be physically dead, but she's still here, and that's why I wear both rings. And she is a brilliant and incredibly vivid presence. I work with others among the dead, I suppose, and possibly with entities that aren't even human or never have been, I don't know. Mm-hmm. This work takes place at a certain hour of the day that in some yoga traditions is known as Brahma Muhurta time, the time of creation. It is about an hour and a half to 2 hours before dawn. And I'm up at that time every morning doing my meditation, which I call the sensing exercise, which I learned in the Gurdjieff Foundation back in the 70s. I've been doing it for more than 50 years now. And when I do it at that time, I become engaged with a level of creativity that's very powerful. And I listen to it. And it has directed me to write the three books I've written recently, Afterlife Revolution, about my experience of rediscovering Anne in an entirely new way after she died. Mm-hmm. A New World, the story of that is about understanding how to actually communicate with the visitors. And now Jesus, A New Vision, which is using the knowledge that comes to me from that level where there is essentially perfect knowledge of history. I was able to rewrite the story of Jesus in human terms. Yes, the resurrection happened. And yes, also, he was human. And what it says, the resurrection says, it says about us and about what we are. Not that we can all die and come back as beings of light, but there is more to us. And his teaching, coming back to the five trees in paradise, is that union with the good leads to love. And as you were saying earlier, love is the most powerful thing in the universe. And he said that we will not understand. I asked her after she died, and one of the first questions I asked her was about gravity, because I know that that people in China, United States, Russia, France, and England have known that there are ships around here that function without gravity, that are gravitic. They have control over gravity. And she said, we will never understand gravity until we understand and can live by the fact that the universe is based on yearning. There is a great yearning that causes the universe to exist. As Annie was passing away, as she died and her soul left, a book flew open on our bookshelf. It's called Physics from Fisher Information. Annie was very familiar with it. And it flew open to a page on which there was, in yellow marks a lot, there was a phrase marked out: the universe began as a single primordial quest for knowledge. And it is getting into touch with this level of consciousness that will also bring us to the understanding we need to express mankind into the universe beyond. And if we are to survive the upheaval that is coming, this is how we will do it. It will not be because Elon Musk succeeds in sending 150 people to Mars. It will be because anybody can go and we can find new worlds for ourselves. But it's not just science that it requires. We have to come to peace in ourselves and with our own souls and with this universe. And all of this is not directly contained in Jesus, A New Vision, but it is a new vision of how to be a good human being, how to live as he lived, and why he lived that way, and why we should too. And it's, believe me, read the book. If you're going to try this, read the book rather than the Gospels. I retranslated the Beatitudes, which are his basic moral code, myself, because the translations that we have are not adequate. So that's Jesus, A New Vision.
Willie, thank you so much for your time and for the work that you do and trying to help souls around the world to go to the next level. So I do appreciate it, my friend.
It's fun to wake up. Never think it's not.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
I feel that the key is to look inward, to find God, to find that higher power within yourself. And when you're able to do that, all things become easier. Life becomes more fulfilling. Things just become clearer on your path. And if you haven't already, please pick up a copy of The Key, A True Encounter. It will shake you and make you think about things a little bit differently. And I'll leave you with a quote from the Master of the Key: hate is like coal, it burns out. Love is like heat, it does not. Now, if you want to go deeper into Whitley's universe, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com www.mankindtrapped.com/004. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a positive review on whatever platform you are listening on. It really helps the show out a lot. And remember to trust the journey. It is there to teach you. I'll see you next time.